section in your operating budget, we always include the capital budget. It's to give you a perspective on where we are on construction and our plans for the next year and what has been authorized by the General Assembly. The only real new addition, obviously, is the General Assembly authorizing the International Center Honors College building. For those of you that are relatively new to the board, the capital budget looks like a large number, $112.8 million. But again, if you look at what's called restricted funds, which the state interprets that as your ability to spend your own money, they give you authority to initiate those projects if you have the money. So that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to spend $37 million. It's authorization from the General Assembly. Also included in the capital budget is an estimated annual capital leases of approximately $2.2 million. Again, trying to find a way to end on a happy note. Ensuring quality higher education is one of the most important things we can do for future generations. Former U.S. Representative Ron Lewis. Not sure how often he gets quoted, but we gave him credit today. So, and obviously you have a happy student that says thanks at commencement, which makes all of this worthwhile. While sometimes it's hard, again, to think of this as a good budget, we have had worse. While this budget doesn't address many of our priorities, it continues to move WKU forward, and it reaffirms our commitment to academic quality. So I'm pleased to present this budget for your approval. Lastly, let me personally thank Kim Reed to my left, our budget director, and behind is Stacy Garrett, our assistant budget director, for doing an excellent job under a hurried schedule because we weren't planning on doing a budget balancing process. They incorporated that and still managed to get the budget done in a timely manner and to you for approval. All three of us are available to answer your questions.
Questions or comments? I'll call for them.
Okay. I suppose to see if I else did. One of the questions that some of the folks who've looked at the budget have asked is, why are we budgeting on fall 2011 numbers? And is there any other institution in the state doing that right now, or are they all budgeting on fall 12?
You know, I haven't asked the sister institutions what enrollment base they use. I do know from my higher education experience that at certain times institutions have actually budgeted on projected enrollment. So there are varying philosophies on how conservative do you need to be in this budget process. We have been assured by the provost and enrollment management that the decline that we experienced, the small decline that we experienced in fall 12, can be recovered, and we've challenged them to be able to make up that difference between the fall 11 and the fall 12. But if not, we will address that in the development of the 2015 budget. I believe it's about 200 students.
Well, actually, the enrollment for fall of 12 was top in terms of headcount for fall of 11. But for budget purposes, it's more important to look at the figure of the revenue. And as we shift our emphasis toward more international students and more out-of-state students, in fact, even with stable enrollment, our revenues have increased. So we're building the budget on the revenue that was there in fall of 11, not so much the headcount. And we're confident, as I said earlier, that with some of the programs we have in place, that is really a good thing.
Okay. But that is a shift, because previously when we came to this meeting, you were budgeting on headcount, right? Okay.
Well, we were budgeting on whether you're full-time, part-time, resident, non-resident. Mm-hmm. So we are building into this budget plan, and we'll monitor it very closely. Tough decisions had to be made to make a $2.1 million budget reduction.
Sure.
And if we had budgeted on the fall 12 level, we would have made additional budget reductions that would have hurt across campus, potentially unnecessarily, if we can actually grow our enrollment in fall of 13.
From a revenue perspective.
Yes.
While we were growing dramatically from 1998 to 2008, we were tracking numbers, knowing that the dollars would follow. As our enrollment has stabilized and coming out of a recessionary environment, and ironically, an improving economy is making our enrollment challenge even more of a challenge, because finding students get a $12 an hour job, and I think I'll keep that job and not come back to school. So as enrollment is stable, but a challenge, mm-hmm. It's more important to track the dollars and make sure that the financial profile is solid and not worry so much about the numbers. So yeah, it's a different dynamic today than it was 5 years ago, to use Ann's budget comparison. And that's just part of the art and science of enrollment management and budgeting, and making sure that since a significant portion of our budget is relying upon tuition and fees, much more so than at any time in our history. So that enrollment dynamic has become a critical part of our overall financial profile, and we recognize that. And so, yeah, we're building the budget based on previous dollars, whereas before we based it on previous enrollments.
Is in regard to full-time undergraduate students, we're budgeting on about 15,000. So 200 is not a big risk, but there is a financial concern about that. But the other variable that has changed is our continual investment in the retention initiatives, and the seriousness down to even the faculty level, that it's everybody's responsibility to help retain students. So we believe those investments in retention programs are going to yield more returning students.
And at what point do we know if we make budget? Because again, if you're using the headcount model, you use census date in late October. Are we still using, is census date still really when we know where we are? Okay.
And well, you're going to get a chief academic officer answer that's different than your chief financial officer.
Okay. What's yours?
From my perspective, I have to wait through all the drops for non-payment, the reinstatements, the students that have protection flags because of financial aid papers that are not finished. The other variable that makes it really unpredictable is on the expenditure side. And that has to do with the fact that we have restructured our institutional scholarship programs. And we don't have historical data to tell you what our acceptance rates are necessarily going to be on some of our new scholarship programs.
Sure. It's uncharted.
The other variable that you've heard about, we call them mandated waivers. It's where the General Assembly has come in and said some very worthy populations really shouldn't have to pay for tuition. And that one is a wild card about how many show up or don't enroll at your institution. We try to budget it the best we can, but that item can run a deficit. So it may look like your enrollment's up, but they may not be paying students. So there's some complexities to
elaborate on that just a minute, because I think it's important that you have this perspective. We spend $4.6 million a year on unfunded mandated tuition waivers that the state says this student should come free. Veterans, orphans, sons and daughters of police and firemen, faculty and staff is a the largest portion of that.
50%.
And if a faculty and staff member from another university wants to take courses here, they can take up to 6 hours free. And we, I guess, have the largest number of that expenditure of all the other universities. For, I guess, lots of reasons that we should be pleased about, but on the other hand, it costs us. Mm-hmm. Now, just yesterday, the day before yesterday, Wednesday, I was at a president's meeting. We spent a lot of time talking about this because as we've grown into our doctoral programs, I'll give you an example of the Doctor of Nursing Practice, the DNP program, where you have a pool of candidates and you select your cohort blindly based on most qualified. Well, what we're finding is a significant portion of that cohort are coming from KCTCS or other universities to get that DNP credential because their employing institution requires them to have that to be on the nursing faculty there. And there is a line in the statute that says these programs must be financially self-sustaining. In other words, the revenue they generate has to pay for that program. And so we raised our hand and said, okay, here's what we're finding. Well, CPE is in agreement, and this is somewhat controlled by the administrative regulations that CPE writes to complete the language of the statute. And so CPE is in a complete agreement that, okay, going forward, you must find out who's paying and who's not paying within the cohort that's been accepted, and you must first enroll a sufficient number of paying students to achieve the statutory requirement that it be financially self-sufficient, and whatever slots are left, you may then enroll those coming on a mandated waiver. Now, I'm summarizing that, but Robin, you're in that discussion. And you know, now this wasn't CP action. It was Bob King and the staff understanding what we were saying and basically agreeing that that's got to be addressed. It's one of those things you learn as these programs are implemented and mature and grow. So that's a good news because that's going to help us ensure that we got a financially self-sustaining doctoral program in the case of DNP and DPT, maybe less so in the EDD, although maybe the same principle there as well. But that's an example of some tweaking that still has to be done. But the mandated waivers as a whole costs higher education about $30 million a year, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, and us about $4.6 million. But we, and you know, they're difficult things to fight. I mean, you can't go to the General Assembly and say, why don't you let us out of these? And, you know, so you want to help pick your audience that these mandated waivers are intended to help. So it's kind of a delicate matter. But yeah, we're spending $4.5 million on unfunded state mandates for particular audiences.
That answers, in part, a different question that I had on page 5 of the narrative, I believe, where page 5 of the narrative talks about the additional document. The agenda item, the revised action item that Julia circulated. You mentioned some of the expenses, the growth in the DNP program, and the fact that a lot of those are coming out of mandated waivers. My other question was about the physical therapy doctoral program, because I went back and went to the board minutes from January of 12 when we approved this. And one of the big talking points for the DPT was, quoting from the minutes, it's important to note that the DPT is self-sustaining from tuition revenue and therefore does not require funding from the Commonwealth or base funding from WKU. Budget is based entirely upon an entire class, 100% paying Kentucky resident tuition. And in the rest of the description, it says that the startup cost was all funded. So I was wondering why there is $631,000 for the DPT here.
It is DPT. I'm going to get that, my doctoral program's mixed up.
Yeah.
It is DPT,
yeah.
Tuition revenue, and necessary for the operating costs of that program. It doesn't include any other source.
What comes in has to be budgeted. That's the budgeted amount of what comes in.
What?
Back to this slide with the balance on it. Yeah, you see the 4.278 appears twice.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, that's because it is specific tuition revenue returned. I don't know if you want to address why are we allocating another $631,000 to DPT for this fall.
Yeah.
But I know that you obviously had to scale up the program. I'm not sure what the specific costs are related to DPT that's in that $631,000.
No, there's a variety of factors, including the lease payment.
But again, that's coming from revenues coming into the program. That's not coming from some other university source.
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
It's the same 4.278 now instead of the balance.
Nursing growth and DPT growth is all in a pro forma related to the direct operating costs plus the estimated lease payment to the medical center, saying that the building cost is in fact paid out of the tuition revenue as well.
So there are no additional monies from the college or anywhere else being reallocated to DPT? Completely self-sustaining, or is there internal reallocation?
Some to salaries. You can see there the salaries.
It's self-sustaining, and it's required to be by statute.
So no additional monies were moved around from any budget to put into that program. Did Ann and Kim have a different answer?
No, I was just looking.
The DNP. Looking at nursing growth and the DNP growth, and we're looking at the lease payment.
Okay, was the lease payment factored into all of this as well? Because I noticed the lease payments are pretty significant, and leases don't go to the board, so that's invisible to us. But
they're listed in the capital budget,
right?
But no, they're not. They're not as they are executed,
right?
The total, I had that. What's the total?
561.
Is that the total lease payment?
Yes.
$561,000 is what we will pay to the medical center for the first year.
Mm-hmm. And that cost is borne by
the tuition revenue associated with enrollment growth in those two programs.
Again, that's a relatively new model that we will likely follow more in the future, where when you create a new expense, you create a revenue stream to cover that new expense, and in this case, it's the enrollment growth in those particular programs. Therefore, we've not made it a practice of designated tuition from a particular program to pay for an added expense related to that program, but we're starting to do that, and the DPT, the DMP are both examples of tying growth revenue in a program to growth expenses related to that program. And we may do that more in the future. It's yet to be determined, but that's not an uncommon practice, but it's relatively new in our budgeting context.
Tough to do.
Okay, so if I may, I mean, if somebody else has another question, please ask. One more comment. Based on that projected shortfall number, which everybody has seen that many times, you're to be commended on being able to do this without laying anyone off. There have been some things that have been shut down that have been painful on campus, but you all are all to be commended for doing that. When I brought up the HEPI issue at the called meeting of the board on April 1st, I was very pleasantly surprised, and I want to thank President Ransdell and Vice President Mead. I've already thanked Athletic Director Stewart privately, but thank you for taking the HEPI out of the equation. That helps. That helps, absolutely, at the student's bottom line. But I'm
you can also thank the Student Government Association and the Health Center and two other enterprises that lost that revenue stream going forward, too. So
there were a number of them.
Five or six different enterprises that have been receiving that increased revenue each year that won't in the future.
Right, and it's something that will have to be dealt with going forward. But when I look at that, and I look at how delicate it is to make budget, at the next meeting we're now going to be voting on that agency bond. This is why I'm concerned. There are philosophical concerns, but there's a major fiscal concern. When we're looking at that kind of shortfall, looking at the health, the fiscal health of the Commonwealth, possibilities for tuition next year. Vice President Mead mentioned the days of 8% tuition increases. Those are gone for a very long time, if not forever, I would imagine. And I'm very concerned about how we make that bond payment going forward based on a very aggressive growth projection for international students. I think it's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous. And what happens if we don't make that? If we don't make that next year or the year after that, then we have to come in and cut the budget somehow because we have to pay that bond debt. And that cut has to be made. So I want to raise that as a concern. And in closing...
No, that's not correct.
What's not correct?
That's not correct. If the Navitas numbers, which we think are very conservative, don't happen, you simply take the same international students are going to be coming whether we're with Navitas or not.
Right, but you're depending on students and tuition revenue to pay for that debt
service. And everything else in this budget.
Yes, right. But you can cut a lot of things, but you can't cut your debt service. I mean, that's a bill you got to pay. That's the point. And if you have to pay that bill, you have to cut somewhere else.
No, that's not true. Unless we drop below 150 international students, and we're at 900 now and plan to go in the future, and yes, that is our plan. But the only way that debt service hits anything else in the budget if our international enrollment drops below 150, and we're at 900 now, and climbing. I don't understand. I'm not following your line of thought because that's simply not inaccurate. If Navitas isn't part of the equation, you simply take the same number of international students in our enrollment profile for the same purpose. And it doesn't matter whether they're Navitas driven or not. Navitas is a convenient way to track it. Mm-hmm. But if they're not the 150 in Navitas, it'll be the same 150 that are in the international enrollment pool. And I've just hinted to you that we will probably begin seeking other dimensions of funding base budget needs out of segmenting some of our tuition revenue, growth in tuition revenue, to do other things in the future. So I'm just not following your line of thought that debt service somehow puts the university at risk when it does not.
But those things are that you've outlined in your earlier narrative are things that enrich the intellectual life and the student life on this campus, and which is what you should do with your tuition,
right.
Instead of paying debt service. Again,
we disagree because an honors college building and an international center are at the top of our priority list, and they will enhance the intellectual life on this campus in dramatic ways.
I think we can debate that point about whether or not that is what enhances the life, or are it the students, as Regent Dodd said earlier, who come that major in other things, and this Honors College provides opportunities and resources. International Student Services provides opportunities and resources, but you can do that out of any space on campus. You can provide those resources and opportunities out of any space on campus. You've done all of the things that you talked about this morning without the building.
Just think what we could do with the building.
Well, okay.
Question for Ann. Correct me if I'm wrong. Our percentage of debt service to operating revenue is, one, what percent? Number two, isn't it the lowest in the nation, just about? And I'd love to operate my household on that.
Can't comment. I haven't tried to track it nationally. It's 4.5%.
It's 4.5%.
And that does conclude the estimated first-year debt payment on the new building.
So statistically speaking, we're in great shape compared to most other universities.
Well, you can either focus on the absolute return, or you can focus on the real return. I mean, the absolute return or the theoretical return. And in this case, we're focusing on $2.2 million, and not that it's one half of 1% of the total overall budget. So it's a deficit, but it's not a monstrous, and the debt service as well.
Our institutional debt is less than 5% of our total budget, which is among the lowest of any university of which I'm aware.
And that's the relative is the other.
Well, in closing, if we're gonna end a budget presentation with our former congressman, I found something from our founder, President Henry Hardin Cherry, that I'd like to share with you. And this is from the annual report from Western Kentucky State Teachers College, and this is the 1932-33 annual report, so at one of the lowest points in the Depression before federal money from the New Deal started to kick in, so there's no federal money at this point. Dr. Cherry says on page 13 of that annual report, Western believes that during the economic crisis it is now experiencing, its success in carrying on depends largely on the faculty it will be able to maintain. It believes that this is true not only during a period of depression, but at all times. It realizes that school systems, organizations, courses of study, buildings, grounds, and equipment are dead and useless things unless they are vitalized by a faculty that has vision, character, leadership, and the spirit of service. Believing this, it recommends that the maintaining of a strong faculty and a fundamental course of study be the central themes and its first objective in the work of organizing a retrenchment program. In order to achieve this objective and to have the money for the operation of the plant, it recommends the following: that all kinds of building programs be discontinued, that all permanent improvement on the grounds be postponed, that a reduction in electricity, fuel, water, and insurance expenditures be decreased when possible, that no further maintenance expenditure be made except as such would be necessary to safeguard life and avoid permanent injury to a building, that the purchase of equipment of all kinds be discontinued except in the case of a small set of items of imperative need, that expenses for extracurricular and athletic activities be reduced if possible. So thus spake Mr. Cherry to a very stripped down version of the mission, but certainly the one that I think has brought us wonderful students like the ones we see in this room today and do the best work that we focused on this morning in our presentations. Thanks.
In 1934, Happy Chandler beat Ruby Laffoon in the election. Western was stripped of all of their master's program and advancement, so the future is not always determined on what the past. So Cherry's caution is that you should always have a fiduciary responsibility. Mm-hmm. It was not to miss the vision because you thought it was going to happen tomorrow. So we cannot predict the future.
No, we can't. We can't.
Yeah, but we don't need to look on the dark side.
Stewards. But we can be good fiscal stewards.
Any other comments?
We present to you a balanced budget.
I hear a motion approving the budget.
So moved.
I hear a second. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Did you get the count through?
Yeah.
Chairman, that's...
Yeah. We now move to agenda item number 2, which is the nominating committee. Call for Regent Johnson to give that report.
Thank you, Chair. The nominating committee is pleased to place the following names in the nomination for officers. The committee consisted of Mrs. Harris, Freddie Higdon, and myself. Our recommendations are the following. J. David Porter is chair. Freddie Higdon is vice chair. Melissa Dennison continuing to serve as secretary graciously. and the board within the scope of its rules again selects someone outside of the board as our treasurer, and that's Mrs. Ann Mead. That concludes our recommendations. And I'd ask for the board's approval of these nominations, or at least the executive committee's approval.
No, it has to be the whole board, doesn't it?
This is the whole board. This is the board meeting.
Whole board?
Yeah,
okay.
Whole board.
So moved.
Nominations, excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I move to accept the report of the nominating committee for the 2013-14 slate of officers.
Thank you.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Got it.
Congratulations, Ann.
Third item is just notification. We have our retreat July 25th, 11 a.m. WKU Glasgow campus. Third quarterly meeting will be the following day, July 26th, 8 a.m. back in this room.
I would two things. One, first of all, I want to invite Regent Johnson and Regent Dodds to dinner that night in Glasgow, and to give us an opportunity to say thank you. Philip and Melissa are planning a grand evening for us. But secondly, in order to make it convenient for everyone, we will gather here in Bowling Green at 10. At the Holiday Inn.
Oh.
And we will have a bus that will take us to Glasgow, the Administrative Council and the board, except those that live there. and obviously we'll have our retreat and a reception for Glasgow area friends, dignitaries, benefactors, and others. And then dinner at the name of the restaurant.
Old French Restaurant.
The Old French Restaurant.
Don't have a new name.
What's the name of it?
Old French.
Yeah. Old French.
And then the
Belauberge.
And Governor Brown used to fly his helicopter down there and have dinner in another era. It's a lovely place. It really is.
Is that the one across the airport?
Yes.
Is this one across the airport?
Right.
Great.
How did you skip the Scottish Inn?
It's what?
How did you skip the Scottish Inn name?
Well, everybody called it the Old French Restaurant. I mean,
they have the Highland.
The Old French Restaurant, yeah.
And then the bus will return everybody back to Bowling Green safely.
From the Old French Restaurant.
Well, it'll be helpful to have two positions in the group.
You won't be on the bus with you.
Yeah. You're on your own on the bus.
We'll be keeping an eye on you.
But you can help us with our co-pays.
Yeah. Okay, please note the other two items on convocation and the trustee conference. That concludes our agenda for today. I hear a motion to adjourn.
I'll make that motion.
Motion made and motion seconded. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no, so approved. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy.